always a help to a speaker. Certainly preachers. I don't know if you've ever tried preaching to a congregation when there's nobody there. It's sort of... It's even better, that's for sure. So let me start off, if I can, turning you to the notes, the overview of community life and environments at the time of colonisation. That's the theme that we're following. And it's an insert. In other words, it wasn't actually part of the original notes. But then when I looked at it, I thought the next stage of the notes sort of comes in to nothing. I start talking about the struggles that they had with ministering the gospel, but I don't actually explain, well, hang on, what was the context in which they first started to come? You know, we've heard of what in fact is an obvious lie, of Terra Nullius. We know that's not true. But if Terra Nullius is not true, there really were people here, what was their life like? What was their circumstances like? So I've dealt just a very little bit with that in these studies here. No man's land, in effect. Nobody lives here. Terra meaning land, and Nullius meaning nothing. So nobody owned the property. Nobody was here. So let's move in. Which, by the way, the colonising authorities knew was a lie right from the start. It was never really believed to be true right from the start, but it was certainly advanced as such. Let's read from Psalm chapter 9, Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them he has set a tabernacle for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoices like a strong man to run its race. Maybe there is something sacramental, something mysterious, a message of God in creation itself, after all. He set a tabernacle for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. Sound familiar? And rejoices like a strong man to run its race. Its rising is from one end of heaven and its circuit to the other end, and there's nothing hidden from its heat. Again, you could change the word S-O-N and S-U-N and put in S-O-N. There is nothing hidden from the heat of his gaze, the heat of his love. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold, sweeter also than honey and the honeycomb. Moreover, by them your servant is warned, and in keeping them there is great reward. Who can really understand his errors? So cleanse me from secret faults. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins, and let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless, and I will be innocent of great transgressions. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my strength and my Redeemer. For the sake of time, I want to skip the first little chapter there, Aboriginal Community Life at Colonisation. You can look at that a little bit in yourself, on your own. And go down to the second paragraph, of the second chapter, Aboriginal and the Environment at Colonisation. Aboriginal Community Life, that should be, and Environment at Colonisation. It may come as a surprise to you, but not all Aboriginal people lived in Worleys. In fact, in 1981, a field survey uncovered approximately 146 stone houses in one paddock. Now, the reason that's in inverted commas is because the idea of a house was never put in the same sentence as with Aboriginal communities. So they've stressed the house aspect of it. These were solid stone buildings. They were permanent dwellings in one paddock by Lake Conda in southwest Victoria. The dwellings were as stable as necessary for the people to stay in an area while the food supply was good. The people utilised clothing made from skins. This is not just the people of the Lake Conda area, but wherever the temperature required it, they used clothing made from skins and finely woven mats for warmth when needed. They planned ahead. Now, just before we leave the clothing department, and go on to the fruit and veg. I don't know whether you've ever realised it, but in the 1924, somewhere around there, Australia went through its biggest ever drought. About the same time, a little bit after that, the camera was introduced into Australia. Colonisation had already started to do its damage. Even before the pastoralists got to the Aboriginal communities, a lot of the diseases of the white people had already done its damage, but a lot of other things had gone wrong also, in that the traditional Aboriginal people received their storyline from neighbouring communities, who received their storyline from neighbouring communities, who received their storyline from neighbouring communities, and they've actually done and charted maps of how the storyline, which is the mythological stories, how they were connected right across Australia. That is not to say that the Pitjantjatjara people of Docker River knew and understood the storyline of the people off of Botany Bay, but the storyline was connected as one group fed into the dream time of the next. And so the community that was here received its storyline. And the community that was over here, they received its storyline. They turned around and they handed the storyline on. These guys received it and they handed the storyline on. So when it came to the receiving the storyline up in the centre of Australia, a lot of the damage was already done because there was nobody to give them their storyline. Because the storyline had been cut off at the beginning. So fragmentation of the community already started long before the white people got there and did their damage. The white people got there and did their damage and they had a ready field to do it in because a lot of the fabric of the community had already started to break up because of colonisation, even before the colonised arrived at the particular geographical area. When they came then to this... came to receiving their storyline or came to the particular culture of an area. I'm sorry, I've lost my thought here for a minute. It'll come back to me. It'll come back to me. No, I hadn't got that far, I don't think. They had received their storyline, and so their cultural fabric was there because they were able to tell the story of their culture. One of the things that we don't understand or have never really understood is that when we look after the environment, we pick up the rubbish, we cut out the prickles and the weeds, etc., and that's our looking after the environment. When Aboriginal people looked after the environment, they told its story. And they nurtured the environment by telling its story because in their understanding, their mythology was that the land would look after them so that they could look after the land's story. And the depth of their culture was dependent on their ability to tell a story. When the storyline had started to fragment because it wasn't coming to them, then they were already starting to fall apart as a community, as a culture. But at that time, the drought occurred, the biggest drought in Australian history. At the same time, the camera was introduced. So what do you think the camera was taking photos of? Fragmented, broken, poverty-stricken, starving, Aboriginal people, often dressed in rags. And if you think about the image that you've been given from your school days, the stereotypical image of an Aboriginal person is probably just that. But that is so far from the reality as to be a joke. Let's read on what the reality was. The people utilised clothing made from skins and finely woven mats for warmth when needed. They planned ahead, sometimes months in advance, in store water and food for intertribal gatherings, such as freshwater mussels, eels, cycad nuts and moths. An interesting little thing, in the hills outside of Canberra, there were the moth eaters. I'm sorry, am I going too fast?
No.
Okay. There were the moth eaters. The moth eaters used to go into the caves around Canberra, and they would put a trench, they'd dig a trench in the side of the cave at the bottom, and then the cave wall would be covered in a sheet of moths, hibernating. And they would simply lift off the bottom of the sheet, and the whole sheet would go down into the trough. They would scoop the trough up, enclose it in clay, and build it into the side of the cliff, and it would stay there until they needed something to eat. Cold storage. You can multiply that time and time again. The cycad nuts was something, if you eat a cycad nut, you will get severely poisoned. But they discovered that the Aboriginal people used to eat the cycad nuts for celebrations and ceremonies, and lots of them. And what they did was actually soak the cycad nuts for several months in advance. So they would know that a ceremony was coming up. They would know there would be a large number of people coming into their area. They would collect the cycad nuts when they're green, soak them in rock holes, etc., for several months, so that by the time the ceremony is ready, they could pull the cycad nuts out and they'd be ready to eat. Forethought, planning. They devised fish traps, some of which are still evident and still in existence. Elaborate water channels to control water courses. They were. Not in a European way. But they certainly were. They knew how to utilise the environment in a way that ministered or worked for them in their cultural framework. It would not have worked for Westerners, but vice versa. And as you look at the state of it, we'll touch the ecology in a short while. Yeah. They certainly were. They did have an agricultural system that was certainly very, very relevant for their time. The climate of pre-colonial Australia was similar to that of today, and the people were subjected to the same extremes in the form of rain, drought, wind, cold, heat, without building materials, heating, cooling, techniques or clothing of anything like the same extent that we have today, which technology has made available for the West. Although the climate differed greatly from one area to the other on the continent, a large percentage of the continent was prone to droughts, and when water holes dried up across vast stretches of land, some groups turned to their neighbours for assistance and temporary assimilation. Now, might I say that the modern concept of pan-Aboriginality is not a valid concept when you're talking about traditional Aboriginal people. In other words, the Walpri, for example, recognised their neighbours, but they were neighbours. They didn't see themselves as in full unity with them, like the concept of pan-Aboriginality, which is basically a government structure to enable the government initially to form ATSIC. Our government structure requires a mirror organisation to deal with. So the government can't just sort of give money to support to individuals. They require a structure through which that can be done to channel. ATSIC was the first one they came up with, which quite frankly I think if it had been given a decent chance would have been very, very successful. And you can say that to your sister. I personally felt that ATSIC had a very raw deal done to it. But anyway. They did actually relate to each other in times of drought. They would assimilate, and as time went on, there were various groups that actually lost their identity. They willingly gave up their identity for the sake of expediency. One of them is the Adnamutna people. Eva's not Adnamutna, I don't think, are you, Eva? No, good. The Adnamutna people is made up of those different groups you'll see down the bottom here. Also the Walpi, the Kuyani, the Yes, and the Piladapa communities. They basically are simply there in the anthropological books. Other than that, they are the Adnamutna peoples, which is literally translated the hills peoples. Now, if you think about it too, the Nurrungeri, it's the same. When Taklum first went down, there were about 21, some say 18, but some say 21, I think 21, but it doesn't matter. Peoples, individual tribal groups that over time, in a very short time, lost their individual identity and became known as the Nurrungeri people. The same thing is occurring, really, in regards to the Wik peoples. You know, the Mabo debate, etc., etc., and the Wik decision of court. The Wik is not actually the Wik people, it's the Wik peoples. They're made up of different Aboriginal tribal groups that are slowly but surely, and have been slowly but surely, losing their individual identity for the sake of political power, really, and just the way things evolve. Aboriginal culture, like every culture in the world, is never stable. If it's stable, it's dead. And I can tell you, Aboriginal culture is not dead. The fact that the people understood, this is the top of page two, the fact that the people understood their environment so well meant that they were able to maintain their viability as distinct groups. Their ingenuity in finding water in the desert is an example of this. An elder member of the Walmudgeri tribe of the Great Sandy Desert in Western Australia explained that in the old days his people died because of intertribal fighting. Then after white people came, they died because of illness and fighting. but it was never due to drought. I'm quite astounded if you were to happen to go to Yalata. I'm not sure if it's still there, but there was for a long time, there were pictures around the walls of the school, in the schoolroom of Yalata. And there they are, there's of an elder holding up about a metre length of mallee root, holding up and drinking from it. There were known, and I think I've actually mentioned it there, there were about seven or eight known water trees. And several of those you could simply cut the roots that normally were a little bit below the soil, the ground level, cut them up into metre lengths and drink from them. And if somebody had to go for a long walk in the desert, they would cut these roots up, plug the ends up with clay, tuck them under their arm and off they'd go. And when they were ready, pull a plug out and drink. Good idea. Tragic when you think of the number of people that have died in this country through thirst when there was water possibly all around them. footnote 4, an Aborigines water quest in arid Australia. McGarry says that how adept the Aboriginal people were in living in the harsh conditions of the outback, Australian outback. In relation to arid Australia, the author lists 11 trees which are a ready supply of water, trees, animals and birds which are known as water finders, collecting dew with a grass sponge, man-made rock holes, dams and wells, and water-carrying techniques. I have a movie at home of an Aboriginal family walking down into a hole. You know, the Bible story of the well that Jacob dug, and known as Jacob's Well. Well, the Aboriginal people had their water holes that their ancestors dug, and bit by bit they would get deeper and deeper, and so the people would walk down into the hole and get water. Josephine Flood states, and that's the book over there, Archaeology of the Dreamtime, not only did Aboriginal men and women living a traditional life have more leisure than is available for the average farmer or office worker, they also generally ate better. Now, one of the things that the missionaries thought they needed to do was convince the people of how terrible their life was. And once you could explain to them their need, then you could come in with the answer. The problem is they could not explain to people that they had a great need, because they only had to work a few hours a day to sustain themselves. The poor white fella, in these days, he had to work 10, 12 hours a day. Well, who had the need? The diet of those groups whose economy has been recorded in detail emerges as far more balanced, varied and nutritious than that of many white people, even today. The Unburra of Arnhem Land had an average intake of about 2,400 kilocalories. Now, I had a lot of trouble understanding what a kilocalorie is in distinction from a calorie. I think it ends up being the same, but I'm not really sure because there is a difference. And also whether a calorie is spelt with a capital C or a little c. But I think a kilocalorie is the same as a calorie. So if anybody can advise me on that, I'd love to talk to you afterwards and I'll put a little note in my studies. 2,400 kilocalories a day, of which 40 to 50% comes from the flesh of fish, shellfish, crustaceans, and about 50 species of land animals and birds. Since the recommended energy intake of adults is about 2,000 kilocalories, the Anbara are feeding well. And if you have a look at Josephine Flood and indeed Brian Atwood, you'll discover that those figures there and the number of hours they had to work was a little bit greater in the desert area, but certainly far less than the average white fella. It was more for the dear ladies than it was for the fellas. But you can see that the Aboriginal people, the white missionaries had a lot of trouble explaining to the Aboriginal people that they had a great need. They only had the need once the white fellas came. Other than one thing, and that's fear. This dietary issue was confirmed by James Cook's observation in 1770. They are far happier than we Europeans, being wholly unacquainted not only with the superfluous, but with the necessary conveniences. They are happy in not knowing the use of them. They live in a tranquility which is not disturbed by the inequality of condition. The earth and sea of their own accord furnish them with all things necessary for life. They covet not magnificent houses, household stuffs, etc. They sleep as sound in a small hovel or even in the open air as the king in his palace of a bed of down. I remember talking to one dear lovely Christian lady, and it's Muriel Olson, And she told me once how scared she was when she first had to sleep in a bed. How can you be safe that far off the ground? And around Aldea in 1941, the Burnts listed 18 varieties of mammals and marsupials, 19 birds, 11 reptiles, 8 insects, 6 water roots, 17 varieties of seed, 3 vegetables, 10 fruits and berries, 4 other plants and fungi, as well as a variety of eggs. They spoke of these as easily obtained and a conservative estimate. For the Walpole, and now, do you know where Aldea is? You got an idea where Aldea is, right? If you can picture the Great Australian Bight, the head of the Great Australian Bight, and go up straight into the desert, maybe 5 hours. I mean, that's in fact, if you can picture where the Trans-Australian Railway line is, at the top of the curve, if you like, of that Great Australian Railway line, and Aldea's right there. And it is desert, for goodness sake. It is dry, sandy desert. Nothing else can be said about it. Definitely desert. And yet, look at what's available to them. In this desert environment, archaeologist Josephine Flood estimated that the food quest occupied less than 6 or 7 hours of work a day for a woman. In an area, now you can take a couple hours off that off for a day for a man. I don't explain why, but that's just the way it is. In an area where the average annual rainfall is between 25 millimetres and 127 millimetres, and the ground temperature ranges from 0 to 71 degrees Celsius. So if that's the situation in the desert, it's a hang of a lot easier for the people that live in the other climates where it's a lot more abundance. The people's apparent communion with the land was dealt a fatal blow by colonisation. The environment changed dramatically and permanently. Fences that were erected either restricted or prevented access to traditional land and or waterholes. The introduced animals often polluted the water supplies. The addition of sheep, cattle, rabbits, I'll come back to that in a minute, water buffalo, camels, donkeys, horses, foxes, cats, dogs and sparrows, as well as land clearing and the European concept of property. Before you change pages, just have a look at this issue of rabbits. Number 10, footnote 10. 24 rabbits and 5 hares were introduced formally and with intent west of Geelong in 1859. But other importations occurred in South Australia and Victoria prior to this, but it's believed they generally didn't survive. It's believed so. Less than 20 years later, they were in plague proportions along the Murray River in South Australia. By 1909, 50 years later, they were in plague proportions on the Nullarbor Plains of South Australia. Plague proportions. And it took, the Mixies virus to eventually dong them, and then more recently the Khaleesi virus. But can you see how native vegetation would have been severely damaged by those precious little bunnies? Colonisation caused extreme hardship and deprivation for Aboriginal people. Introduced plants such as Salvation Jane, Bathurst Burr, Prickly Pear, St John's Wort, Onion Weed. I used to be a beekeeper, and when I was a beekeeper, we harvested Onion Weed that was a great honey producer, and we tried to sell it in England. They wouldn't buy it, the idea of buying honey from Onion Weed, for goodness sake. The name then was changed at a higher level in the country than me, of course, to Mallee Star. Sold like a flash. Skeleton weed, boxthorn, cape weed, cape tulip, lantana, water hyacinths, blackberries changed the appearance of the countryside and destroyed natural vegetation, and therefore the food source of the Aboriginal people. Significant ecological deterioration was recorded by settlers in 1851 after only 20 years of farming. Now, I personally don't believe in the idea that Aboriginal people have been here for over 40,000 years. I'm actually a young earth believer, and I believe in creation. But whether it be 40,000 years or 10,000 years, the fact is the Aboriginal people knew how to farm the property. They knew how to look after the land, and they did. We come along, and within a very short time, we've started to destroy it. I'm not anti-mining. I believe the Genesis record actually instructs us. That's part of our mandate, to mine the country. But if you go up and do a trip up through the central Western Australian area from what's Kalgoorlie to Leonora, and up into Mount Margaret and Warburton Ranges, you will see some unbelievable scarring of the planet. I was shocked. I had never seen holes so big, damage so permanent. I don't believe we have been authorised to do that. I don't believe that's our mandate. I think we should have a committee meeting on that. Go ahead, Suze. I think you're right, looking at it from the Aboriginal point of view, whatever was on their land in their area was theirs. So when you had white people bringing in the wildlife, and it wasn't long before Aboriginal people realised that the sheep actually taste quite good, it was easier to catch than the kangaroo in many ways. So you start to have the competition setting up and the idea for conflict. Remembering too that the white people did bring down incredibly harsh and cruel penalties on the Aboriginal people for killing a sheep or a cow, but these were people that came from England where you were hung for stealing a loaf of bread. So you've got to, you know, when you look at things in perspective, you can start to understand a little bit reason of the tension. By that I'm not trying to justify it in any way, but you can start to understand a little bit of the tension. Within 100 years of European settlement, the destruction of traditional land and the breakdown of the established inter- and intra-tribal relationships meant the disintegration of cultures as cohesive entities. The beginning of the disintegration. This occurred at a faster pace than the founding of official European settlements and resulted in demoralised Aboriginal communities called blacks camps, or fringe camps, being present prior to or developing with the towns. These camps were normally one or two kilometres from town and often close to the rubbish dump, affording the Aboriginal people an ample supply of building materials for wurleys, called wilches by the Pitjantjatjara people, and discarded furniture and clothing, but it also increased the negative stereotyping by the white population. We caused the problem, we then stereotyped the people that fell into the problem. I'd like now just to read, if I can, from Amos chapter 4. And might I stress, I'm not just doing this to give a nice religious flavour. This is the dynamic, I believe, that is happening behind this whole colonisation process and now the next stage when the colonials are starting to take root and the conflicts are setting up. It's Amos chapter 4, reading from verse 6 to verse 12. Also, I gave you cleanness of teeth in all your cities and lack of bread in all your places. Yet you have not returned to me, says the Lord. I also withheld rain from you when there were still 3 months to the harvest. In other words, complete crops were destroyed. I made it rain on one city. I withheld rain from another. One part was rained upon, where it did not rain, that part withered. So two or three cities wandered to another city to drink water, but they were not satisfied. Remember I mentioned Aboriginal people would go to other tribal groups for support and for to have their needs met if there was a drought. Yet you have not returned to me, says the Lord. I blasted you with blight and mildew. When your gardens increased, your vineyards, your fig trees, your olive trees, the locusts devoured them. And yet you have not returned to me, says the Lord. I sent among you a plague after the manner of Egypt. Your young men I killed with a sword, along with all your captive horses. I made the stench of your camps come up into your nostrils, yet you have not returned to me, says the Lord. I overthrew some of you, as God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, and you were like a firebrand plucked from the burning, yet you have not returned to me, says the Lord. Therefore, thus will I do to you, O Israel, because I will do this to you, prepare to meet your God, O Israel. Notice how they are to be prepared to meet their God. Famine, drought, disease, sickness, fire. Prepare to meet your God, O Israel. I said last week, God loves us too much to let us go. And that has nothing to do with the colour of your skin. God loves all of us too much to let us go. And he will go to great lengths to bring as many Aboriginal people into his kingdom as he has ordained. And we take great delight in that. Aboriginal health at colonisation. George Worgan, a medical practitioner from the First Fleet, noted that the Aborigines seemingly enjoyed uninterrupted health and lived to a great age. Food and water were in ample supply, even in the harshest of desert conditions. Pastor Hoff of the Lutheran Mission at Coonabra speaks of the tribal peoples as a community-loving people. They are good-natured, kind, carefree, and always ready to share. R.M. Williams. Now, I've actually got a faulty footnote there. R.M. Williams spent many years travelling with the people of the Western Desert, and he wrote in his autobiography, which is Beneath Whose Hand, if you could write that in for me, that the desert people lived in a state of mental contentment. And then the footnote that I've got there, verse 14, you should actually put in, see also Sherry Sagers and Dennis Gray, where they basically say the same thing. So the confusion with the footnote. Now, if you skip over to the final page, page 4, and I'll just read this quote and then leave this section here, and it may be time for a cuppa. Or not yet? Okay, all right, we'll keep on going to the next notes. Ancient traditional Aboriginal religion. Most traditional, that is, religious systems on the Australian continent have no eschatology. Everybody happy with that word? Eschatology? Okay. No eschatology or salvation belief. No paradise or state of ultimate happiness, defined as being free of the inconsistencies, injustices and unhappy condition of mortality, as evident from the beliefs about death as the ultimate end, with the concomitant feature of second burial. In other words, for example, the Unbladawitch people, the Aliwara people, north of Alice Springs on the Sandover Highway area, they, up until around about 10 or 15 years ago, still treated their dead. So when somebody had died, they'd build a platform in the trees, and they put the body up there, and the birds, et cetera, would gradually, the flesh would decompose, without going into details. And then they would come along several months after, collect the bones up, put them into a package, and ceremonially bury the bones. Then the description of the Aboriginal religious system as static and immutable, allowing for no change or development, whether collectively or individually, towards a peaceful millennium of the equality of all people, may seem to have a certain validity. It also seems logical that if there is no paradise and no hell, no reward and no punishment, and if humanity is but a reincarnation of dreaming heroes, that under these precepts the universe with its existing features does not require any effort of people to become better or more godlike. So in other words, basically what he's saying is that there's no future orientation in the religious framework of traditional Aboriginal life. The one thing that he doesn't go into in this quote, which is very easy to demonstrate from other quotes, is that the driving force that governs, if you like, and controls the direction of a culture, the Aboriginal culture, in a traditional life, was tended to be fear. If this is what you're looking forward to die, it is nothing to look forward to. And what the missionaries eventually had to learn is that they had to stop trying to bring about the Church of God and share the gospel in the context of explaining to people their great need. You know, that's one of the things that we do, rightly or wrongly. You know, you see a starving person in the street and you direct them along to Westcare, or if the Church of Christ have a facility in the city, you direct them there, and you hope you can look. I've met you, fed you now, and I've met that need. And do you have any other needs? And you try to draw them into the church through meeting their needs. But if they have no needs, how do you do it? And the Aboriginal people had no needs. So when the white fellows came along with this belief, this sincere belief that to Christianise meant to evangelise, meant to introduce their society, their culture to the people didn't want to have a bar to do with their society, with their social values, with their culture and the understanding of how to be fully human. You know, they were more than happy the way they were. And who can blame them? So if the missionary had been able to separate their understanding of the gospel from the understanding of culture, they would have been able to get a lot further, a lot quicker. But they couldn't. Close those notes now if you can. The thing people normally think of when you mention the first fleet is convicts. And to a degree, we're right. Because the colony of New South Wales was formed by convict settlement to provide an answer to Britain's overcrowded prisons. However, other citizens came with the convicts. And it's good to actually keep this in mind. Officers, administrators, marines, surgeons. Now, they might not meet our criteria for a surgeon today. I can just imagine what they had to deal with, let alone what training they might not have had. Tradesmen, and sometimes they came with wives and children. And, of course, there were also children amongst the convicts. A 9-year-old, for example, was sentenced 7 years deportation. 9 years old. Not with his family. 7 years. It's just mind-boggling. Just mind-boggling. And, of course, with such a large community, it was seen fit to send clergymen. These were no religious misfits selected by lottery. And this is, I think, very significant. They were carefully chosen by evangelical leaders of England for their love of the gospel and their missionary zeal. That's a very important point to keep in mind. You see, God did not leave Australia without witness, right from the start. Now, the creation gave witness to the Aboriginal people. We read that in Psalm 19. It may not have given witness to Christ or to Jesus, but it certainly told them they were in need of a saviour. And if they had called out, they would have found him. Even though the whitefellas hadn't yet come. Ask me to explain how. I don't think I could. While the government was preparing the ships of the First Fleet, William Wilberforce and John Newton of the Eclectic Society convinced the Prime Minister, William Pitt the Younger, of the need of a chaplaincy for the convict colony. They proposed Richard Johnson, who in October 1784 was appointed chaplain of the settlement of New South Wales and consequently also became the chaplain of the First Fleet. Keep in mind, when he came as the chaplain of New South Wales, that included South Australia. Before the fleet sailed, Wilberforce introduced Johnson to the Societies for the Propagation of the Gospel and the Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge. Both these organisations owed their origins to the great revivals in England. These organisations supplied Johnson with 4,200 Christian books for the new colony to assist him in this new ministry. 4,200 books. Gee whiz, I wish I'd been there at the time. I would have even invested in a couple more bookshelves. The First Fleet arrived in Botany Bay on the 17th of January 1788, and the 3rd February that same year, Richard Johnson arrived. Now, if you understand a little bit of early Australian history, you realise the First Fleet was split in half. And the first part was to get here with the food and the supplies ready for the second part. Johnson was in the second part. The other way around. What happened is that the guys that were supposed to get here second got here first, and the guys that were supposed to get here first got here second. But anyway, that's the wind of time. Richard Johnson presided over the first divine service on Australian soil under some trees, or a great tree. He preached from the text, "What shall I render unto the Lord for all his benefits to me?" Psalm 116:12. In that psalm is also that beautiful verse, "What can I offer to the Lord for his salvation? I will offer the cup of my salvation." Very significant. On the 70th of February, he celebrated Holy Communion. This is why it's significant. In a marine officer's marquee. This officer, whose name we don't know, was so conscious of the significance of the occasion that he wrote in his diary, now housed in the Mitchell Library in Canberra, "I resolve to keep this table as long as I live, for it is the first table that ever the Lord's Supper was eat of in this country." The church was planted. The gospel began. For the duration of his tenure, it was said that Johnson was one of the hardest working members of the new colony. Trevor, we've got a long way to go. In the first 5 years, he almost single-handedly carried out all the clerical duties of the colony. He held worship services either in the open air or in storehouses at Sydney and Parramatta. He officiated, and here's, how'd you like this workload? 226 baptisms, 220 marriages, 851 funerals, as well as serve as at executions and minister to the convicts. I'll look after you now and I'll hang you tomorrow. So one of the convicts wrote home in 1790 that few of the sick would recover if it was not for the kindness of the Reverend Mr. Johnson. What a testimony. Whose assistance out of his own stores makes him the physician both of soul and body. In 1793, he built and paid for his own church. He had general supervision. Now, it's interesting that he did that because the governor of the time was busy building his second governor's house, both very palatial. And the governor thought it was more important that he have a second house, governor's house, than it was to build a church for the colony, which was, by the way, his charter. That was what he was instructed to do, build a church. He had general supervision over the increasing number of schools, and in August 1800, when the governor set up a committee to open and manage an institution for orphans, Richard Johnson was appointed as its treasurer. We are given an even greater insight into the heart of the man when, upon the arrival of the Second Fleet, he ignored John Newton's advice that it will be madness in you to risk your health by going down into the hold of a ship where the air must be always putrid from the breath of a crowd of passengers in chains. Now, how would John Newton know that? He was a slave trader. He knew what he was talking about. The passengers of the Second Fleet were in the most shocking state, and yet Johnson disregarded the risk of his own health and went into the hold of the ship to care for the sick and dying. Now, if you can go down to the footnote there, number 3, here's the quote. And it's from Sydney Daily Mirror, 3rd of March 1969. That's a correct date. But what the Sydney Daily Mirror has done is actually put a facsimile of the press of the day when the ship arrived. So this report was actually written on the day or the week that the ship arrived. And the Sydney Daily Mirror put a facsimile of that report in their paper on the 3rd of March 1969. At last the transports are here, diabolical conditions of the convicts thereon. 278 died on the fearsome journey to Sydney Cove. The landing of those who remained alive, despite their misuse upon the recent voyage, could not fail to horrify those who watched. As they came on shore, these wretched people were hardly able to move hand or foot. Such as could not carry themselves upon their legs, crawled upon all fours. Those who through their afflictions were not able to move, were thrown down over the side of the ships, as sacks of flour would be thrown, into the small boats. Some expired in the boats, others as they reached the shore. Some fainted and were carried by those who fared better. More had not the opportunity even to leave their ocean prisons, for as they came upon the decks, the fresh air only hastened their demise. A sight most outrageous to our eyes were the marks of leg irons upon the convicts, some so deep that one could nigh on see the bones. You know, you can't justify that behaviour, even by thinking, well, you know, that was those days. But what it does enable you to see is how they were able to justify such incredible cruelty to the Aboriginal people when they did this to their own. Such was his concern, Johnson's concern for the souls of individuals. He believed strongly in personal salvation, and so it was important to minister to Aboriginal people and convicts alike. Now remember, this guy was appointed for his missionary zeal, his love of the gospel and his missionary zeal. And he recognised right from the start that responsibility goes to Aboriginal people as much as white people. But keep in mind, his charter was white. And that didn't change for a long time to come. He befriended Aboriginal people, even to the point of taking an Aboriginal girl into his family. And at one instance, he gave himself as a hostage so that Bennelong could feel safe while visiting the governor. It should not surprise us that with the pressure Johnson was under from political oversight, his own conscience and expectations and his strong desire to minister the gospel and see fruit to his labour, that he struggled throughout his ministry to reconcile these three foci of his calling: ministration of the church, guardian of public morality, and evangelism. His life and ministry became an example of the tensions that plagued Aboriginal ministry, to Aboriginal people throughout the history of missions within Australia. The struggle of balancing these three points, these three obligations of guardian of public morality, ministration of the church, and evangelism. And might I say, this is similar to problems that we still have. For example, if a pastor comes into the Churches of Christ or the Lutheran Church from a upper middle class white Australian background, then he comes to minister to his own people. And part of that ministry involves the established structures that we grow up with. That's just part of our culture. If an Aboriginal person comes into the ministry, that Aboriginal person brings with him all his social and cultural obligations of his own society, his own community, plus those of ours. Now, it's hard enough for an individual with a good education, coming from a very functional family life and being secure in themselves, it's hard enough for us as an individual to minister within our own cultural group. But when you come from another culture that is quite possibly from a dysfunctional family situation, from struggles, maybe not even as high or as good an education as a European pastor, to come into a situation where he's automatically assumed he will accept responsibilities to his own culture and that of the European structure, it's a hang of a lot harder. And I would say so demoralising that it almost always invariably sets an Aboriginal person up to fail. Certainly burns them out long before. The mortality rate of Aboriginal pastors is a lot lower than it is for white fellows. It's a great tragedy, and I think we have a lot to learn in that regard. But these three issues, balancing these three points of ministration of the church, guardian of public morality, and evangelism, is very, very difficult. And Johnson's life testified to the struggles of that. Samuel Marsden also gained the interest of an evangelical group within the Church of England. But in his case, it was the Ellen Society. This group sponsored young men from poorer families for ministry training. When he was 24 years old, he met members of the Clapham sect, including William Wilberforce. Wilberforce went on to have a major impact on the rest of Marsden's life, just as he had had on Johnson's before him. He recommended Marsden to the position of assistant to the chaplain of New South Wales. In other words, Wilberforce recommended Marsden to assist Johnson, which Marsden accepted and subsequently arrived in Sydney Cove in March 1794. On his first Sunday in the colony, he wrote, "I preached the gospel of deliverance from the captivity of sin. I was returning home, and a young man followed me into the wood and told me how he was distressed for the salvation of his soul. I hope the Lord will have many souls in this place." You can see where his heart was right from the start. And by 1810, Governor Macquarie founded the Native Institution for the expressed purpose of removing Aboriginal children from their parents. Can you see? The rot started right at the beginning. However, ministering to Aboriginal people was not as rewarding for Marsden as ministering to European settlers. And maybe, it's thought, because of an experience he had with an Aboriginal child named Tristram, who lived in his home for many years. When Tristram reached puberty, he walked out of Marsden's life, and Marsden interpreted this as rejecting him and his faith. Then there's this incredible statement. "Humanly speaking, nothing could be done," he said, "to bring Aboriginal people to the knowledge of God." As far as Marsden was concerned, because Aboriginal people rejected outright material civilization, they were also rejecting the necessary first steps toward conversion. He wrote, "The natives have no reflection. They have no attachments. And they have no wants." Can you see that's almost identical to what they discovered in Aldea and Coonabah? And if you read widely, you'll find it's the same thing said universally. Aboriginal people were fine. They were well-fed, happy, content. knew about community life, shared abundantly. But the missionaries saw that as a failure. How can you preach the gospel to somebody who thinks they don't need anything? Marsden's work was not a complete failure, however, as he feared. He was also instrumental in establishing a CMS auxiliary in Sydney in 1825, an organisation that would prove to be very significant in the 20th century in Aboriginal ministry in the Northern Territory, Queensland and Western Australia. Now, it's a bit sad that Marsden is referred to often as the whipping padre. he was forced, the same as Johnson was, to be involved in discipline. And hence this issue of trying to balance his responsibilities to his government, his administrative responsibilities, and these sorts of things. So it was very difficult. So I think it's a little bit harsh to refer to him as the whipping padre. Because he was forced by the government requirements to be involved in disciplining. And at one particular count, he over-disciplined in whipping. I could imagine somebody losing it. I just getting so emotionally drawn in. I don't really know the situation or what was in his head, but I just think when you look at his whole desire was to bring about the conversion of people, and Marsden grew in his appreciation of Aboriginal people, but then swung right back, and he ended up feeling, well, hang on, he's not getting any benefit from this ministry. And so he ended up then focusing on ministry to white people, then went across to New Zealand and was very successful in his evangelical ministry in New Zealand. He was perhaps the most successful in his ministry in New Zealand. So, like Johnson, Marsden also believed strongly in the importance of personal conversion, and that material advance was a proof of the genuineness of one's personal sense of salvation. Now, I think there's a huge problem there. A huge problem. The material advance, where are we? The proof of genuineness of one's personal sense of salvation. This helps us understand why, for a large part of his ministry, Marsden believed that Aboriginal people had to be civilised before they could be evangelised. However, he later changed his mind on this point. Praise God for that. And he declared, civilization is not necessary before Christianity. You will find civilization follows Christianity more easily than Christianity follows civilization. Now, that's fine. The problem is that the later missionaries actually grabbed hold of that and then said, well, if you want to be a Christian and grow and mature as a Christian, then you have to build a house. You have to have a table. You have to sleep on beds. You have to learn how to drive a tractor and plant wheat in rows. You see, even though they didn't make it a condition of evangelisation, of conversion, they made it a condition of maturing in the gospel. And a huge number of missionaries did that. It was pretty well a universal problem. This is the position advocated by the Church Missionary Society, which specifically instructed its missionaries, do not mistake civilisation for conversion. While you rejoice in communicating every other good, think little or nothing done till you see those dead in trespasses and sins quickened together with Christ. Now, there's a full stop at the end of that sentence. If only there had been a full stop at the end of their intentions. To enable somebody to grow in the gospel does not mean at all that they grow in our cultural understanding. However, in the latter part of his life, Marsden, his evangelical zeal waned, and therefore he has been somewhat overshadowed by some of his subordinates. Despite all their weaknesses, contradictions, and conflicts, Johnson and Marsden were men of faith. They had a love of God and a desire to see his gospel proclaimed and received in the new colony by both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal alike. But remember, their charter for both of them was white. Other missionaries in the first period of colonisation, other Christian workers who expressed their concern for the spiritual welfare of Aboriginals, were Reverend Robert Cartwright, Anglican, Reverend Samuel Lee, Methodist, Reverend William Walker, Methodist. The Wesleyans were the first to appoint an official missionary to the Aborigines. Good on the Methos. They were the first. Reverend William Walker, 1821. The CMS followed in 1822 with George and Martha Clark. I knew there was a claim to fame somewhere. These were the only missionaries appointed for the Sydney area. In 1824, the Anglican Church of Sydney appointed Archdeacons Scott and Brown to minister to the Wiradjuri in Wellington Valley. William and Anne Watson and Johann Hunt joined this work in 1832. Reverend James and Lydia Gunther in 1837. Iper was a German Presbyterian missionary at Moreton Bay in New South Wales. In 1837, the Catholic Church began its ministry to Aboriginal children. The first period of Lutheran mission work began in South Australia in October 1838. Within 20 years after Marsden's ministry, 104 clergymen received financial support from the New South Wales government. But none of these second-generation pastors focused on Aboriginal ministry. None of them. The situation, however, changed by 1944. Exactly, I don't think you can put an actual date on when it changed, but it had evolved. By 1944, there were 317 missionaries serving among an estimated 76,000 Aboriginal people across Australia. Now, I don't know what that number of Aboriginal people means. Remember, this was an era before Aboriginal people were counted in the census. So I'm not sure whether that means just traditional people, whether it means traditional full-blood people, whether it's a count-up of all the people involved in mission communities around Australia. I don't know. And because, quite frankly, I think that is quite wrong, that figure. But it's the official figure. Nowhere near high enough. Nowhere near high enough. I don't... Oh, way too low. 12,000. Oh, heavens yes. Way, way too low. Conclusion. It seems that there was a first flush of missionary activity fueled by the close ties that the colonisers had with the leading Christian Lights of England. However, it seems that three related forces came to bear upon their efforts that caused them to feel defeated and then to give up. A lack of appreciation of the part their own culture played in their understanding of the gospel. A lack of appreciation of the significance and complexities of the Aboriginal cultures. Should be an S on the end of that. And last but not least, a lack of understanding of the depth of cultural trauma caused by the colonising process and even by the very presence of the missioners themselves.